Ragtime to Rock and Roll. In episode 16, over there, Kenneth Moore looks back on what happened musically in America during the latter part of the war, when Hollywood dreamt of a white Christmas, but was awake enough to mass-produce musicals, when Tin Pan Alley offered solace and sentiment and silliness, when Broadway struck gold in Oklahoma, while in the record studios, the musicians simply struck.
You'll never know just how much I miss. Just how much I care. And if I tried, I still couldn't hide my love for you. You ought to know, for haven't I told you so? A million or more times you went away, my heart went with you. I speak your name in my every prayer. If there is some other way to prove that I love you, I swear I don't know how. You'll never know if you don't know now.
By 1942, in the groove was one of those expressions which anyone with pretensions to being hep might have used to indicate that musically or otherwise things were going well. And apart from severe wartime restrictions on the use of shellac, the raw material of records, things were going well for the American record industry, in a sense that demand far exceeded supply. At that point, the American Federation of Musicians decided, literally, to get out of the groove and simply forbade its members to make any more records. The result was not immediate total silence, since the AFM didn't include singers or harmonica players. The record you just heard, in fact, got around the ban by using voices only, Dick Hames and the Song Spinners. In any case, record companies always have plenty of unreleased material in the can. But there are limits to what you can do with voices and mouth organs, and sooner or later, even the best stocked seller will run dry. So at the end of July 1942, the future of recorded music was more uncertain than at any time since the days of the cylinder and solo whistling. The reason for this extraordinary situation lies in the small print of old record labels. This is William B. Williams, a New York disc jockey who, ironically, makes his living by playing records over the air.
I don't know if it's still true on the old 78 recordings. If you have a collection at home, you might look at it. But under the label of what the tune is and who the artist is, there's a little line that used to run around the label which said, "This recording is not for broadcast." And as I remember, Fred Waring, Paul Whiteman and the AFM took radio stations to court in an effort to stop them from broadcasting this material, but they lost.
Took his belongings and mounted his saddle, but he never started.
Billie Holiday with Teddy Wilson. And if we appear to have retraced our steps, it was to show what a dilemma the musicians were in. That record was one of a whole series made primarily for the black jukebox market in the 30s. But by the 40s, the jukebox had become an important secondary target of the musicians' anger, since along with the unrestricted playing of records over the air without any further payment, it was reducing the number of jobs going for live musicians. So, if they couldn't control the use of the records they'd already made, the musicians decided with a kind of grim logic that the answer was to stop making records altogether. The strike had a number of effects, and one of them was felt even before it came into operation. There was a rush to get into the recording studios while there was still time. Peggy Lee, then Benny Goodman's girl vocalist, got her first big hit because of it.
Many people thought that I wrote Why Don't You Do Right. It was written by Lil Green. I used to play it constantly. And Benny's dressing room was next to mine. And it drove him up the wall. And he said, would you like to sing that song and get it out of your mind? And I said, I'd love to. So they had an arrangement made. And it didn't make any big splash. Then time went on, about 2 years, and we were told there was to be a record strike. So Benny recorded everything that he had in his books, and that included Why Don't You Do Right. They put out everything that he recorded. I think Why Don't You Do Right was about the last thing. They're at the bottom of the barrel, and it was an instant hit.
Records that just made it up the gangway before the American Federation of Musicians cast off in 1942. Whether or not the AFM acted wisely in calling a strike of its members is still good for an argument 32 years later. The leader of the band, James C. Petrillo, as the then president of the Federation, had no doubts whatsoever. Now over 80, Mr. Petrillo is said to draw quiet amusement from the fact that ex-President Nixon was once reported as saying that Petrillo ought to be jailed. Mr. Hal C. Davis, now himself president of the AFFM, talks about the Stormy Petrillo.
Well, Petrillo is a very peculiar individual. In fact, his name itself lent use to the newspapers of turning things about because his name was James C. Petrillo, and they immediately put the Caesar to the middle initial and called him James Caesar Petrillo. And President Petrillo is quite a dynamic and fiery individual. And he just lent himself to good press coverage, I guess. But all of his actions were first approved by either convention action or the International Executive Board. But the press at the time didn't want to consider that, and they just turned it around so it looked as though here was James Caesar or Czar Petrillo just running things arbitrarily, and this, of course, was not the case.
George T. Simon was editor of the enthusiast magazine Metronome at the time of the strike, and he could see a clear division of interest within the musicians' camp.
I think the big band leaders were definitely out of sympathy with Petrillo. They wanted to go ahead and keep their names in front of the public. They had a big investment to protect, and they couldn't quite see why they were being sacrificed for the sake of a whole slew of part-time musicians who were part of the Petrillo empire, you might say, and whom Petrillo needed to keep them in power. There was a lot of politics involved in this thing, and all the band leaders I knew were vehemently opposed to this sort of strike, even though they knew that Petrillo was trying to do things for the sidemen, and the sidemen appreciated that they were, but at the same time they were killing the goose that laid the golden egg, so that there was a very rough time, and there was a lot of hard feelings at that time toward Petrillo, who I must say, you know, I've got to say that he acted in good faith and really thought what he was doing was correct. I just felt at the time, I used to run editorials saying that I thought he was being very short-sighted about this thing and that he was hurting the whole progress of instrumental music. And as it turned out, we on Metronome were right about that. He did hurt it very badly.
Evening shadows make me blue when each weary day is through. How I long to be with you, my happiness. Every day I reminisce, dreaming of your tender kiss, always thinking how I miss my happiness. A million years, it seems, have gone by since we shared our dreams. But I'll hold you again. There'll be no blue memories then. Weather skies are gray.
Ella Fitzgerald's version of My Happiness was one of the few a cappella records to become a hit. A cappella, by the way, is Latin for the band's on strike, and we've got to use the song spinners again. The producer of the record was Milt Gabler, who explains how musical necessity was the mother of two-part invention.
My Happiness was a song Ella didn't like to start off. It was such a corny ballad, but it was a hit by John and Sandra Steele. Well, there are no musicians on the record. We just had a choral group humming. And we did, I remember I had two-part harmony. I had the choral group do everything in unison, a third away from Ella. So it would sound like the two-part harmony, and I had them very soft. And I think we had a ukulele player. In those years, ukulele players weren't in the union. And we had a bass voice doing like Papa Skipper Mills used to do with the Mills Brothers. And that was the record, but it was a giant record for Ella.
I suspect Milt Gabler's memory was playing him false because, well, I don't think I could hear a ukulele in there. Ukulele players, though, were certainly beyond the Petrillo pale, and so were harmonica players. The reissue of old records, with the added attraction that it didn't cost anything, was another possibility open to record companies. Sigmund Spaeth, in his book A History of Popular Music in America, has told how, in 1943... when the film Casablanca used and made popular the 1931 song As Time Goes By, an old Rudy Valley version of it was put out again for the lack of new recordings. A form of recording completely exempt from the strike was the V-disc, made for the entertainment of the American Armed Services, and touched on in an earlier episode.
Thank you.
for thee. For the gods of love look down and laugh at what romantic fools we mortals be. And now I know my love was not for you, and so I'll take it back with a sigh, for pity is one goodbye.
Benny Goodman's Perfidia with Helen Forrest, originally made as a V-disc. The making of V-discs was one of the things George Simon was involved in during the war. Here he describes what he was able to record during the commercial recording dispute.
It was fantastic, the stuff that these guys wanted to do, because musicians are creative people who want to get their message across. And the only way they could do it in those days was V-disc, and it was a ball for me, you know. This little captain who was in charge of V-disc said, record them wherever you want, wherever you want, just as long as you can get them for free. Well, I talked to Goodman, I talked to Woody, I talked to Harry James, and then I talked to other people. Louis Armstrong did a fantastic session for me. And even the singers were anxious to record, because they could record with great musicians instead of recording with vocal groups. Ella, I remember, did some things with Buddy Rich behind her that were fantastic. And all sorts of other singers were recording for us. It was just a fabulous thing for me in the Army to be able to have this font of musical lore and being able to put it on recordings merely because they weren't able to record for anybody else.
You're just too marvelous, too marvelous for words, like glorious, glamorous, and that will stand by amorous. It's all too wonderful, I'll never find the words that say enough, tell enough, I mean they just aren't well enough. You're much too much, and just too very, very to ever be in Webster's dictionary. And so I'm borrowing a love song from the birds to tell you that you're marvelous, too marvelous for words.
Harry James and Too Marvelous for Words, which is what the V-discs were, I suppose. Certainly, for over a year, they were the only source of new recordings by established musicians. In the end, the strike was settled, but not all at once. The American Decca Company gave in first in September 1943, 13 months after the musicians had taken their Trappist vow. The two other major American companies, RCA Victor and American Columbia, stuck it out until the theatrically appropriate moment of Armistice Day, 1944. The terms of the settlements were complex, but in essence, they forced the record companies to pay a small royalty into an AFFM fund, which was then used to pay musicians to put on free concerts. As Roland Gillette says in his book The Fabulous Phonograph, this did not obliterate the menace of mechanical music, but it soothed its injury with the balm of money. Several reasons, apart from the immediately obvious ones, forced the record companies to give way. One was a near mutiny on the part of classical artists. The other was that although, in theory, the reissue of earlier material could have gone on indefinitely, popular music, in particular, is like a girl's wardrobe, constantly changing. And while the strike was on, something very new had indeed been happening on the musical stage.
Sweeping down the plain, and the waving wheat can sure smell sweet when the wind comes right behind the rain. Look, Oklahoma, every night.
watch a hawk making lazy circles in the sky. We know we belong to the land, and the land we belong to is grand. And when we say,
yo!
Hi-yi-fi-yo-yi-yi! We're only saying, you're doing fine, Oklahoma!
Apart from reaffirming the sacred principle that the Broadway stage should be the chief source of good popular music, Oklahoma, like its story, was a settling of new territory. Alfred Drake was in the cast when it opened in New York in 1943, and he remembers it as being the first musical to offer something new in presentation, form, and style for a very long time.
It wasn't really until Oklahoma that there was a direct change. Now, there had been other musicals, such as On Your Toes, in which a ballet was a serious part of the plot. And Balanchine had done other shows in which he used the ballet form. But the use of dance as such all the way through, and the integration between book and lyrics and music, was a pasting together of a lot of old things which ended up by being something rather new at that time. Each one of these things had been done before, but putting them all together in one show was perhaps for the first time, I think. I wouldn't guarantee that because I'm talking about America. This kind of form had existed before in Europe, not only in England, but on the continent. I believe that one of the major factors involved was that Oklahoma was based on a play called Green Grow the Lilacs. And Oscar Hammerstein had great respect for that play and recognized its inherent values and kept as much of it as possible. I remember the day that we were sitting down, he was talking to me about what he planned to do, and he said, you know that speech that Curly has when he talks about the Surrey and all the rest of that? He said, that's going to be a song. I'm going to keep everything that's in there. And he did. In other words, the song became an integral part of what had been there already, and of course the music added to it.
When I take you out tonight with me, honey, here's the way it's going to be. You will sit behind a team of snow white horses in the slickest gig you ever see. Chicks and ducks and geese better scurry when I take you out in the Surrey. When I take you out in the Surrey with a fringe on top. Watch that fringe and see how it flutters when I drive them high-stepping strutters. Nosy pokes will peek through the shutters and their eyes will pop. The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown, the dashboard's genuine leather. With eyes and glass curtains you can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather. Two bright side lights winking and blinking, ain't no finer rig I'm a-thinking. You can keep your rig if you're thinking at a tier-tier-swap for that shiny little Surrey with the fringe on the top.
I think also it had something which was necessary perhaps at that particular period in time. In any event, the combination of all the circumstances, the fact that there wasn't a line of showgirls, that the girls wore dresses, the singers actually sang, and the dancers actually danced, and the performers actually acted as well as sang. I mean, they were actors as well as singers. I think all of these things put together made it a very important force in the theater. The war was on, and this was a kind of going back to our history, which, of course, romanticized. We could look on with a certain amount of pride in our heritage. Also, it was very colorful, and it brought back to the American audience a feeling of, well, we were something, we can still be something. I'm sure that the times had a great deal to do with its success.
Well, as we've seen so often in this series, it's a question of timing, of having history on your side. Rodgers and Hart had just been a little too early with Powell Joey. Rodgers, Hammerstein, Oklahoma, and history met with the precision of trapeze artists, and the musical world duly gasped. Richard Rodgers had found the ultimate partnership. For all the sheer intellectual brilliance of his association with Larry Hart, it was with Hammerstein that he was to achieve a popular success so great that it hurts your head to try and imagine it. He also attained a working tranquility he had never known before.
It was a tremendous relief. Oscar was the organized man. He was slow. But to say that Oscar was slow isn't much more of a comment than to say that he was tall. This was simply the way he was. He didn't work rapidly. Larry did. I did and do. But Oscar simply was not fast. And this is no handicap at all. If he wanted to take 3 weeks to do a lyric, why not? Didn't make any difference in the final outcome. Just so long as the lyric was good, and usually was.
Out of my dreams and into your arms, I long to fly. I will come as evening comes to a waiting sky. Out of my dreams and into the hush of falling.
Impression now is that the music was there. I don't actually remember writing it. Certainly there was no great effort in writing it. And I think anybody who knows the job of writing music would have found those words irresistible. You couldn't stop music from coming.
It was a beautiful day for Broadway as a whole. And that's not just a sweeping statement of the kind that historians are prone to. It's also the view of a man who was to have a Hammerstein-sized success as a lyric writer himself with My Fair Lady 13 years later. Alan J. Lerner.
Well, yes, because you see, when Oklahoma opened in the spring of 1943, that's when the really great age, the belle époque of the musical theater began. And it flourished then for the next 20 years. And set a pattern and set a trend that others built on after following that, very much the way Jerome Kern did back in the early 20s, and then Anne Gershwin, who influenced then everybody who came after that. Well, in a sense, Oklahoma influenced everything that was written after that. And fundamentally, the whole history of the theater changed, musical theater changed after that.
Oklahoma, the start of what Alan J. Lerner called a belle époque in the musical theater. But even when Oklahoma was new, the stage supplied only a portion of our musical groceries.
Lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. Pistol packin' mama, lay that pistol down. Oh, drinking beer in a cabaret, was I having fun? Until one night she caught me right, now I'm on the run.
Oh, lay that pistol down, babe, lay that pistol down. pistol back and mama laid that pistol down. Oh, I see you every night, Bing, and I'll woo you every day. I'll be your regular mama, and I'll put that gun away.
Oh, lay that pistol down, babe. Lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama. Lay the thing down before it goes off and hurts somebody. Oh, she kicked out my windshield, and she hit me over the head. She cussed and cried and said I'd lied, and she wished that I was dead.
Oh, lay that pistol down, babe. Lay that pistol down. Pistol packing mama, lay that pistol down with three tough gals. From deep down Texas way, we got no pals. They don't like the way we play. We're a rough, rootin', toot-toot trio, but you've seen a sister Cleo. She's a terror, make no hair, but there ain't no life to bear.
Lay that pistol down, babe. Lay that pistol down. Pistol bagging mama. Lay that pistol down.
It's hard to define in words the difference between a theatre song and a Tin Pan Alley one-off hit. But you don't have to be an expert to realize that Pistol Packing Mama could hardly have come from Broadway. That was an American 1943 hit and was able to become a hit because the record company to which Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters were signed had come to an agreement, as we've already seen, with the musicians. Johnny Burke and Jimmy Van Heusen had a big one at around the same time with Sunday, Monday, or Always. Mersey Doats, which, depending on how you looked at it, was either gibberish or a comment on the way we garble our own language, drove everybody mad, but was at least musically simple enough for large audiences to bawl in unison fairly accurately. The sing-song repertoire had received a permanent addition. There was also the phenomenon of the unexplained revival.
I'm gonna buy a paper doll that I can call my own. A doll that other fellows cannot steal. And then the flirty, flirty guys with their flirty, flirty eyes will have to flirt with dollies that are real. When I come home at night, she will be waiting. She'll be the truest doll in all this world. I'd rather have a paper doll to call my own than have a fickle-minded real-life girl.
I'm gonna buy a paper doll that I can call my own. A doll that other fellows cannot steal. And then the flirty, flirty guys with their flirty, flirty eyes will have to flirt with dollies that are real. When I come home at night, she will be waiting. She'll be the truest doll in all this world. I'd rather have a paper doll to call my own than have a fickle-minded real-life girl.
By 1943 and 44, when it became a really big hit, Paper Doll had already been around for a quarter of a century. Now, practically, the biggest success of the whole period was connected with the astounding rise of one of the new young singers. Whether Frank Sinatra helped this song more than the song helped him is now purely an academic question. What matters is that they were absolutely right for each other.
Kathy's heart and mind embraces all they're through. In that small cafe, the park across the way, the children's carousel, the chestnut tree, the wishing well. I'll be seeing you in every lovely summer's day, in everything that's light and gay. I'll always think of you that way. I'll find you in the morning sun, and when the night is new, I'll be looking at the moon, but I'll be seeing you.
Frank Sinatra with Tommy Dorsey and his orchestra. So far, we've made no mention of what was possibly the biggest hit song of all time. It came from Hollywood, which, in the period we are talking about, was turning out musicals the way Lockheed was making airplanes. The film was Holiday Inn, 1942. It had Bob Crosby's band, it had Fred Astaire and Marjorie Reynolds, Bing Crosby, and a song containing these words.
The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day in Beverly Hills, L.A. But it's December the 24th, and I am longing to be up north.
And in that improbable fashion begins what is perhaps the best-known Christmas pop song of all time. A song which is said to have sold more copies on record than any other, Irving Berlin's White Christmas. Even the record industry itself has lost count of the number of times it's been recorded. Not that it matters, for it will always ultimately be identified with Bing Crosby.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the one where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow. Of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write, may your days be merry.
Even if you didn't know the verse, there can't be anyone who doesn't know the chorus of White Christmas. Bing Crosby remembers how this song was first presented to him by Irving Berlin.
Well, he thought it was a nice little song, as he described it. I have an amusing little number here. Of course, when he demonstrates a score, which he does before a picture for the cast and the director and everybody, he's not the best demonstrator in the world. He has tremendous enthusiasm, but you have to hug him to hear him, you know. He's a tiny little voice, and he plays really kind of a broken-down piano. He has a device on the piano. He's a lever where he can shift keys. If the key he's written it in or knows it in is not the key you can sing it in, well, he can shift it for you. But he's a dynamic little fella, and from the very start, when he starts the score, he follows it right through to the cutting room floor. He's right there all the time. Takes a tremendous interest in anything he's written that's going to be used. And, of course, he was the greatest song player of all time.
May your day be merry and bright.
And may all your Christmases be white.
White Christmas, won an Oscar, and continued with unabated popularity from year to year until most people had forgotten just which film it came from. To confuse matters, 12 years after its original appearance, Bing Crosby made a picture called White Christmas. It's arguably not the greatest song ever, but its vital statistics are impressive. Over 200 different recordings have been made, with a total sale of 90 million copies, of which Crosby has accounted for around 25 million. Certainly more impressive than some of the actual musicals that Hollywood saw a duty to produce. They can't all have starred the Andrews sisters, but that's how they linger in the mind. Their subject matter seems to have been shared among the American armed services in much the way political parties in this country get equal airtime. Johnny Doughboy, Buck Privates, The Fleet's In, Keep 'em Flying, Here Come the Waves. In a movie which found a fairly tenuous story in the exploits of some servicemen on leave, the team of Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer created a song for which the only word is inspired. One for my baby and one more for the road. Johnny Mercer sets the scene and describes the character that Fred Astaire played in the film.
Well, he was a soldier. He was an airman on leave in the war. He came back to see his girl, and through some misunderstanding, he thought that she didn't like him anymore. And she walked out on him, and he thought so. And he went to the saloon and started to get drunk and wound up the last customer there and sang this song to the bartender. Then, like a lot of drunks do, he got angry, danced on the bar, broke a lot of glasses, quite a tour de force of dancing. And a very good introduction for the song, although I saw it as always as a more introspective, reflective song, you know, kind of a quiet song. I didn't know. I didn't think all the drunks in the world would rally around and make that song such a big hit. Everybody who carried a torch or who drank or who lost a girl, they all love that song. That's beyond my understanding.
It's 2:45. There's no one in the place except you and me. So set 'em up, Joe.